I stood in that studio and I wept. Pretty devastating time, really. I was in the studio, though, when something happened that could have stopped his career in its tracks.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Paul Burnett.
I can be one of very few people who, at the age of 8 years old, heard my parents on the radio. My parents were very kind of, I guess you'd say, bohemian, really. But my father's a musician, was a musician. My mother was a singer. They worked together. That's how they met and all the rest. She'd be the Cinderella in the local panto and all that up in the north and everything. And my father, for the first 5 years of my life, like most of my generation, was in the army. Between 1945 and 1950, we lived in a caravan, going where the work was, as many people did in those days, housing being very short. That was my life. I went to 10 different schools. But on one occasion, I remember it vividly. I'd be about 8 years old. My parents thought it'd be great fun. They had a gig for a BBC radio station. I think it was in Cardiff. I remember them giving me strict instructions. The alarm clock would go off at 9 o'clock that night. All I had to do is wake up and press a button on the radio, one of those little press button things in the caravan, and then I would hear them on the radio. And you know, I did, and I remember exactly what my mother sang. Someday he'll come along, the man I love, and he'll be the man I love. She sang that. My father, I think, was playing the accordion as an accompaniment. He was a pianist. And there was an applause and everything. And then I remember what was a lovely moment. I went back to bed and I was asleep, or they thought I was, and I heard them coming in to the caravan. No secrets in a caravan. They were giggling, and obviously it had been a good night. As I look back on it, they peeked in on me. It was lovely. I remember just hugging my pillow.
Someday he'll come along, the man I love, and he'll be big and strong, the man I love.
What is sad about this is because a couple of years later, my father went on the road, and I saw less and less of him. A few years later, they divorced. They were both young. They were 20 when they married. You can imagine the beginning of the war and all that stuff. Thing is, though, we carried on living in a caravan. So when other people were getting TVs and so on, radio was still my conduit to a wonderful world out there. So all the comedy shows, you know, Round the Horn and Take It From Here and all that, this is what I love.
Take it from here.
But there wasn't much music, really. Ann Ziegler and Webster Booth seemed to be the main diet for the for radio, the light program, as it was then. But I discovered AFN, American Forces Network, had DJs. I mean, long before they became, you know, like pirate radio, but I thought back to these guys with great voices, and they played some fabulous music. That and Radio Luxembourg. Radio Luxembourg was always big in the north because the reception was much better in the north.
Which reminds me, the wind is whistling through this studio door today. I think Jack Jackson's been eating beans again. I can always tell. But right now, Johnny Cash, you
so,
tell me.
So, you know, I heard these Pete Murray and all that. By then I'm a teenager, I'm working and all that. It was as much the presentation as the music, I have to say. So I'm working in a department store, left school at 15, 2 weeks after my 15th birthday, you know, no qualifications whatsoever. I've been in this dead-end job for in the bins in Darlington, and I loved it. I must say, department stores are a bit like show business. You're on show and all that, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, lovely, and it's all about, it's kind of theatre there. But then you get to an age, and also I'm living alone at home with my mother, you know, and arguing with her all the time, poor woman, you know. And at that point, Doug Hillary had been my good friend from Carpets thing, and we got talking, and he said, "Why don't you join the RAF?" So we joined, went to Newcastle, did the test and everything. I ended up in some what they call shinies in service terminology. There's clerical, because your seats of your pants are shiny because you sat down all the time. And about a year after I joined, I was sent to Aden in the Middle East, which is the way of it in the services. At first, I got there and I thought, this is a hellhole. The heat and the smell of goats and camels, and, you know, it's like stepping back 2,000 years. However, there was a little radio station called AFBA, Aidan Forces Broadcasting Association, and it was based out at the airfield in Cormaxa. I was at Steamer Point, which was where the main base was, and so every evening I went down there. I met this guy who worked down there. He says, you'd really fit in. Of course, you wouldn't get on the air, because the only officers get on the air, which I fully accepted. That's how you conditioned it. Of course, what were they thinking? I got down there, straight away they put me on the air. I did every kind of, I did jazz programs, I did a sporting program once. I know nothing about sporting. I wish I had a recording, I would give anything for it. That kind of, you know, freedom to do what you know, liked, gave me such a taste for it. In fact, so much so that when it was time to come home, I stood in that studio and I wept. Because I thought that was the end of, how was I going to get to radio from that, you know. But I had heard about Pirate Radio, which had just started.
You're tuned to Radio Caroline on 199, your all-day music station.
As I left in 1965, Pirate Radio started. I was based, when I came back, in Dishforth, RAF Dishforth, kicking my heels until my time to leave the RAF came about. 5 years I signed up for. In the meantime, I got a job as a resident DJ in the top rank in Darlington. So I used to go up to this, change it into the blue mohair, you know, very Beatles sort of look I had. And I loved it. 5 nights a week. Money was good. And I bought a little car to be able to do all this. I did RAF during the day, this at night time. The manager of the dance hall gave me £20 a week to buy all the records for that. That was, I'd go into the local music shop, select the records that were going to be big in the dance hall, and I've loved all that. And with this money, you know, they must have thought I was... Anyway, so there was an advert in the NME for DJs, you know, 6 Chesterfield Gardens, famous address, Radio Caroline, Radio Caroline South, headquarters there. Caroline! Got the train down from Darlington to King's Cross, went there, had an audition. It went very well. Ken Evans was the guy who looked after all that kind of thing. He sent me a letter to Darlington. I remember getting the letter. I've still got it in a scrapbook somewhere. Really impressed with your, you know, and we'd love to have nothing to offer you at the moment, but I can promise you we'll be in touch. I knew what the standard letter was like, you know. Thank you for your interest. They really appreciate it. I've seen one of those for a friend of mine. I had one. So I thought, oh, this is really good. I showed it to the manager of the dance hall, who immediately got in touch with the local paper. He was very, thank God, he was that kind of guy. He had the Evening Dispatch in local man to join. Oh, I was so embarrassed. Oh, no, I didn't say that. It's a possibility. Oh, but anyway, from that piece in the paper, a radio station was starting up in Scarborough, and they contacted me through that article. As a result of that, Don Robinson, who was the boss of Radio 270, this new radio station, contacted me and said, would I be interested? But here's the funny thing. He said, would you go up to Newcastle? We're holding auditions there. And then a little right opposite the railway station, there was a little office that they'd rigged out as a little radio station, a couple of turntables, you know. And I always remember sitting in the waiting room there, oh, so nervous. And there's a few of us, and the guy who was going to be in before me suddenly leapt up and says, I can't do this. he just ran out. And Jane Wilde, a very glamorous, very 60s-looking girl, she was the sort of receptionist there. I was very impressed with that. I thought, this is it. This is the world I'm going to hopefully join. She had one of those crocheted 60s dresses on, very short. Anyway, she was quite a doll. I went in early, sat there. First record I played was Roy Orbison. Only the lonely. So I just did, you know, what I'd been doing, you know, on AFBA in Aidan. The guy who was running the whole thing, who was quite a name on television, in Tyne's television, he told me, hey, well, you've got the job. I'll tell you right now, you'll get a letter. And I walked from that place back to the railway station to go home. And I was, people would talk about, your feet don't touch the pavement. I was so elated, so excited. I'm on the train going back. I'm still in the RAF. I'd got another 6 months to do in the RAF because I'd been so conditioned with working at night times and this disco and everything. Oh, God, what am I going to do? Cut a long story short, you could buy yourself out of the RAF. And my mother cashed her premium bonds, 125 quid, and I bought myself out the last 6 months of my career in the RAF. From there, I went on the ship. We went down there, we being all the guys come from all over the country, well, there's only six of us, to take up our position on the ship. And it was in the Scarborough Harbour. We were all a bit disappointed in the size of the thing. It was quite small, not what we quite expected, but it's still very exciting. We're going to be on the radio. We're going to go on air April 1st. We had to go out and meet the ship coming up from Great Yarmouth, where it had been having its last fitting out. And we took records and everything onto the ship, worked overnight cataloguing them, because next day we're supposed to start, you know, 3 miles off Scarborough out in the sea. I was violently sick. I'd not realised that I was very susceptible to seasickness. Next day was beautiful, not a cloud in the sky. We moved out there, 10 o'clock, this storm comes up. There were no clouds or anything. It was just the sea just rose up, and it had a brand new ship. It was only 150 foot long, and it had a 150 foot antenna. And that, in the course of the morning, snapped off a third of the way up. The hero of that day was a guy called Roger Gale. Now, the Conservative MP for Thanet North and Sir Roger Gale. I was very impressed with him. He was a good-looking, swashbuckling guy, very confident, very self-confident. We're all cowering below deck because this mast is just scything its way, crashing into the bridge, pulling us over to a, I don't know, 30-degree list, going to drag us under. And I wouldn't have cared. I was so ill, I wouldn't... God, die now. Look, take me, God. This is awful. He was up there with the crew, with an axe, hacking away until they severed this thing that was pulling us over, and it sank beneath the waves. This brand new 10,000 pound antenna sank beneath the waves, along with all our hopes of any broadcasting career. We thought we were towed into Scarborough Harbour, and that was it. We were sent our separate ways. Thought that was a short-lived career. So that was a rather ignominious start to the radio station. Anyway, they were wonderful people, actually. They just started again, got a new antenna, and said we were all sent home. However, they needed a couple of guys to be a night watchman on this ship while it was being refitted in Grimsby. Hal York and I took turns looking after the ship. By then, there was a whole change of attitude about what kind of radio station it was going to be, because they wanted a kind of a home service type of radio station. The typical Wolf Proudfoot, this, you know, I'm not having that pop music blaring out everywhere. We're going to be a bit more than that. You know, take the BBC on at their own game and, you know, and be down your way and all that kind of stuff. It's going to be awful, actually. In the meantime, Don Robinson said no. He'd been to the States and he knew, you know, what kind of music the kids wanted. Hal York and I were the only guys that were brought back to the station from the original crowd, and the hero of the hour, Roger Gale. We were the only three that were originally lined up.
And a very good evening to you on this Monday evening.
So we went on the air, I think, June, and it became a very successful station.
And it's yours truly, Paul Burnett, here with you until 9 o'clock.
Anyway, come August of 1967, the bill's gone through to shut us all down.
Good night and goodbye. Radio 27 Hour is now closing down.
And very quickly I realised that we're going to be 200 guys all looking for radio work, and so I had an agent at that time who got me a job, or had an offer of a job at Manx Radio in the Isle of Man. Not as much money, but that was okay. Terra firma. So I worked in the Isle of Man from March 1967 to September 1967.
This is Manx Radio, broadcasting on 1.8 meters on the medium wave band, and also on 89 and 91.2 megacycles VHF from Douglas, Isle of Man.
And we'll be broadcasting. I did the breakfast show, that's 5 days a week. 3 days a week, I did the afternoon show as well. Just loved it. Yeah, I did everything. But it was a station, it was on the seafront, Douglas seafront. You know, it looked like one of those boarding houses, but the ground floor was the radio station. I used to let myself in to the building at 6 o'clock in the morning, let myself in, take the milk in off the doorstep, go in, throw these big switches that turn the transmitters on while they warmed up. I made a cup of tea and I, you know, get myself all sorted out. Had a very interesting music format. Play what you like. I can't see how, well, God knows what that must have sounded like, but I loved it. I had an MGB by then, an MGB Roadster, which I was very proud of. So I had that parked on the front there. It was a good life.
We now have a list of lost and found property as supplied to Max Radio by the police authorities in Douglas. First of all, the lost property items, and if you know the whereabouts of any of these items, then please contact the Douglas police station or any of its details of high time.
But unfortunately, I was fired in September of that year. I was the only, this is my reasoning, I was the only non-Manxman on it. And I think that kind of rankled with it. It's a very insular sort of place. Plus, I had trouble announcing Gaelic names. As luck would have it, I used to, the Isle of Man in the summer, all the big stars, David Jacobs, Alan Freeman, they all came over. One of the nicest guys was Pete Murray, who came over. I would always take a little tape recorder down, interview them for my show. Pete Murray, it was just about time I knew it was all going belly up there. And he said, well, how do you see your future? I said, well, not much here, I'm afraid. And he said, as it happens, I know that they're looking for somebody on Radio Luxembourg. Would you like me to put a word in for you? Pete Murray, who was the biggest name, and the guy I really actually tried to base myself on. We all adopt somebody that is, always liked his humour and kind of nonchalance, and I thought that was a great person to be. So here's Pete Murray telling me, you know, would you like me to put a word in for you? I didn't hear anything. I came off, it was a week, the only week in my life I've been on the dole. So I was a week on the dole, and I got a letter from Radio Luxembourg saying, would you like to... And the guy that was at Radio Luxembourg was Ken Evans, the guy that had overseen my tape on Radio Caroline. So that plus Pete Murray's endorsement, you know, and they needed, when they said they needed somebody yesterday, they were just, they said, when could you start? And I said, well, any time you like, really. Tomorrow? We're in London now. And Luxembourg tomorrow? Yes. We'll take you in your car, put you on a plane. You could fly from Lyd Airport to Le Touquet in France. To fly with your car on a plane. You can't do that now.
Turning on the good vibrations.
Reggie's.
Spinning all the winners for you.
Reggie's.
Stay with the station that'll bring you all the best in music.
And it was the 27th of October, 1967. There wasn't a cloud in the sky, and I had top down on the MGB, one suitcase behind me, and I drove over the Ardennes, arrived in Luxembourg. It was nighttime by the time I got there, and there's a park, and the radio station with a tower and everything is in the centre. And 6.5 very happy years working with guys I know to this day, Kid Jensen, Tony Prince, Mark Wesley. You know, what was wonderful about the station, we were the same team for pretty much 5 years. You know, Noel Edmonds came and went.
This is the Paul Burnett Show on Radio Luxembourg.
I'd only been there a few months when I was asked, would you like to do a show with Pete Murray? And it was called the Peter and Paul Show. Couldn't wait to tell my mother. Sponsored by Clark Shoes. The idea would be that we'd be like a two-way family favour, so with pop music. Pete would be in London, me in Luxembourg, doing a two-way thing. However, they sold the show to Clark's already when they found out that technically it wasn't possible. So they used to fly me from Luxembourg to London, and I was sitting in a studio with Pete one side of the table, me and the other, him asking me how the weather is in Luxembourg, and me asking, and what's it like in London right now? And we did that whole series. It lasted about a year. What was the nice thing, I would always fly back that evening, but on a couple of occasions I couldn't. And Pete was living with Valerie Singleton at that time. So I'd stay at their place, a lovely mansion flat in Marylebone. I can remember how I felt sat there watching TV with Pete Murray here and Valerie Singleton, two big iconic sort of figures in television and radio at that time. But we got on really great. Lovely, lovely guy.
And that's the one we're playing once an hour. It's a good sound from Marmalade, and I think we're back on the road. Here's a dedication on the programme from member number 13930 in the Club 208. The name is Kath. Good evening, Kath. He'd like us to play a record for all the hard-working mums in the world, especially yours, saying that we think she's lovely, and for Chrissy, my best friend, who always listens to Radio Luxembourg. Embarrassing if she wasn't. Right now, for you, it's Carole King and Smack Water Jack.
Well, Luxembourg, then, in those days, and again, pure luck, really. The Pirates had closed down. Radio 1 had started, but they used to go off the air at 7 o'clock in the evening, exactly when Radio Luxembourg used to come on the air. And for a while, we had it all to ourselves. And that was really when it was huge. All the stars came over. Kit Jensen had a show called Jensen's Dimensions.
Kit Jensen!
Lou Reed, little 72 rock, called Vicious from Transformer.
He was great because that was very much his kind of music, all the avant-garde stuff and everything. Deep Purple, they all came over, and then we'd all go to local nightclubs and jam, you know, and sing, and Beach Boys came over, did a concert with us, because they were queuing up to be on Luxembourg, and especially when we did these concerts, because there was a small theatre, and it's like the Broadcasting House has a little theatre, maybe a couple of hundred people, because Radio Luxembourg, we were just a small part of it. The German service, the French service, the Dutch service, the local Luxembourg service, and they all combined to broadcast these concerts. Because behind the Iron Curtain, we were huge. Tony Prince did some gigs behind in Czechoslovakia, which was unheard of. I introduced the Beach Boys. Lovely guys, they were fabulous, and I love their stuff and everything. So that was a wonderful moment live. And then the next one, I think it was a couple of weeks later, was Grateful Dead. And Kid Jensen was going to introduce them on stage. And one of the French announcers, without meaning to, said it was a free concert. He meant that they weren't getting paid for it. They were doing it for the Eber. But he was telling the whole of Europe that the Grateful Dead were going to do a free concert. We were besieged, hitchhiked, train, plane, you name it. We were really in a state of siege. Now, the funny thing is that this radio station, Radio Luxembourg, was built on the foundations of an old castle, and it had a moat with a drawbridge. That moat came in so handy because they were, you know, and of course very angry that they couldn't get in because they'd been promised a free concert, you know. So that was interesting, but here's the best thing for me. Kid Jensen, he had a lovely, he showed me, he said, what do you think? And he showed me how he was going to introduce this legendary band, The Grateful Dead. And I said, well, that's great. He goes up on stage, we're all sat in the right at the back, because it was a real hippie sort of atmosphere. I'm sat there at Kid's, I could tell he was really nervous, especially with this baying crowd outside. It was like, you know, something of the French Bastille or something, the height of the revolution. He went up on stage, the seconds it was coming up to midnight, suddenly one of the Grateful Dead roadies rushed across the stage, had a knife poking into Kid's, and somebody said, where do you think you're going? And Jerry Garcia, the lead man of the Grateful Dead, said, it's okay, it's with us, it's okay, leave him alone. Folded his knife and went off. Of course, Kid's, ladies and gentlemen, the Grateful Dead just ran off. That was his. All this preparation we got to. The building was very much like the kind of thing you see in those Nazi films. You know, marble staircases. Right? You know, it was a very sort of that era. There were a pile of, you know, what a pizza carton looks like. If you can imagine a stack of those to the ceiling. I was curious, I said, they're going to be thrown out, you know. I pulled one open, opened it up, and it was a set of very large 78s. Some of them were shellac, you know, and if you tried to separate them, when I think about what we must have destroyed, because we didn't know, we were just pulling them apart, but there were some that were like a rubber mat on a turntable. They were like that. And he put the needle on the inside and they worked their way out. And what they were was the entire Nazi propaganda output from the day they took over, they were occupied Luxembourg during the war. And the reason they used it is because, well, a lot of people don't realise, Radio Luxembourg was very popular in Britain before the war, on the long wave. And so when the Germans took over, here was a natural conduit to the British public, who were used to tuning into that frequency. Lord Haw-Haw, William Joyce, he was the voice on most of these discs. I still have them.
Now I say to you, my English listeners, the trouble is this. Germany, if you like, is not...
One of the great stories that about the occupation that I know, I came off the air one night, there was an elderly, I say elderly guy, a guy my age, but he worked there, and we got into conversation, and he said, well, I was in the Luxembourg resistance, and he told me the story, which I just thought was fantastic. He said, I still worked as a junior at the radio station, and the Germans, as they were pulling out, mined the whole building. Luxembourg is riddled with subterranean connecting ore paths, 1,000 years old, all tunnels. They contacted Patton's army, who sent some rangers in. They were engineers, and they went down into and defused. Otherwise, the whole building would have been destroyed. One of the rangers, and the reason they sent him was because he had been a studio engineer for Bing Crosby in Hollywood. They found these machines down there, Telefunken or, you know, Grundig or whatever, big machines. They were the very first tape recorders anybody had ever seen. Everything hitherto that had been straight to disc or wire. So you could only have one thing. And he recognised the potential there, and he took those machines back to Hollywood with him. They were taken, you know, to the Bing Crosby studios. And that's when multi-tracking that was started, and the very first hit that came out of that was Les Paul and Mary Ford, Somewhere There's Music.
Somewhere there's music, I'll fade the tune. Somewhere there's heaven.
When we joined the common market or European Union, Jimmy Young came over to Luxembourg, and he went to every city as part of a, you know, celebrating the whole fact that we were joining the European Union. Hard to believe now. He did a show from all the major capitals of each member country, which weren't that many then.
Pete Murrisky, is that open house? Or put another way, morning all. Thanks to Pete Murray for open house, and welcome to the Jimmy Young programme, which, as Pete just said, is coming to you live...
And Doreen Davis, who became deputy head of Radio 1, she was his producer, and she wanted to have a conversation with... some expats then, and she chose myself and Nicole and Darren, our firstborn, would be about 2 years old. So we were in the studio with Jimmy Young. He was very offhand, and he wasn't in a good mood or something, Doreen said after. She apologised for him afterwards, but he was very offhand and not at all. That was our connection with Doreen Davis, and she obviously went back. Johnny Beelan contacted me and asked if I'd be interested in... The funny thing was, he asked me to come over for a chat, and I met Derek Chinnery, who was the boss of Radio 1 at that time. He said, right, you got the job. This is after a nice long chat. I had to catch the ferry back to Luxembourg. I drove over, and he said, do me a favour, don't say anything until we've issued a press release and everything. And I went back. I found out that the Evening Standard that evening had a release, you know, which is terrible, because Alan Keane was our boss, a lovely man. Can you imagine? I've been there six and a half years, and that's the way he finds out I'm leaving, you know. But that's the way it is. I was going to the next day phone him up, explain, you know, and he would have understood. But he just thought he was really upset, which kind of left a sour taste in the mouth. However, I joined Radio 1, and that would be in February of 1974. Roscoe had the Saturday show.
Wake up, music! It's the Beatles' B-side.
And I must have talked too fast, rabbited my way through it. Obviously, it was okay because I carried on doing that. And then from then on, Johnny Walker refused to play the Bay City Rollers. Sort of left on that. I could never understand why you'd put your life, because basically the brothers would be dead in a few months. That's the nature of those, you know. If you're a top 40 station, you can't not play the whatever's, you know, there. And actually, I didn't mind, it was all right, but I knew what they were. They were just going to be, you know, a year later, people wouldn't cross the road to me, you know. So anyway, he went off to the States. I got his job, you know, which was fine by me. And had a, you know, good few years there. Tuesday we did the chart. I kind of, just a brief kind of what's new and what's number one. The big chart was going to be at the weekend, but that was when, well, I meet people now who are at school and they said everything stopped. Everything stopped for that, or to see what was it. Fascinating, really, isn't it?
Climbing six to number three, Frankie Valli and Greece. Dreadlock Holiday, last week's number one, is down one place to number two. That means we've got a brand new. Now, what else could it be but John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John with Summer Nights from the film Greece, up 10 places to the top spot.
An innovation I introduced was Fun at One, which was because I'd grown up listening to some great Woody Allen and Bob Newhart and people like that, and you'd never hear their routines. And I thought lunchtime people would sit down and have it, so we'd pay attention, you know, more than they would during the day when they're working or whatever. And it was very, very popular. 1 o'clock, Fun at One, jingles and everything.
Right, it's just coming up to 1 o'clock. And of course that means it's time for. Today is John Cleese and Connie Booth, not out of Fawlty Towers, but off their Mermaid Frolics LP, and this is the bookshop.
And I had
sketch.
Actually met, I did a satire show on Capital with Angus Deaton, Josie Lawrence, Jan Raven, a whole bunch of, and we used to have young comics coming in. It was a satire show. Commercial radio had never done it before, and it was very, very popular. And I did writing for it and everything. But it was amazing how many comics back in the 90s were saying, that's when I first heard routines, stand-up. I like to think that, you know, because we have an explosion of, you know, stand-up comics now in this country, but originally a lot of them had never heard somebody do a three-minute routine. One of the best things I got was a letter from the guy who fires the 1 o'clock gun on Edinburgh Castle every day, the 1 o'clock gun in full regalia. He asked me, would you leave it a couple of minutes, you know, and so I did. From then on, it was always Fun at One-ish.
Hello, this is Super Scouts calling. Anyone out there, come on.
Hello, this is Plastic Chicken, go off.
What it was Dave's idea, just for something that we'd record for his show and my show, like that little jokey thing. Mutual friend of ours, Wayne Bickerton, sadly no longer with us, and he was just opening up State Records. So he said, oh, I can get some publicity out of that. Do you mind? He said, I could, you know, put the music to it and everything. But we only had one line. That was Dave's line. You know, it was a foggy day on the 5th of May in a scammel hauling bricks. It was just cracking dawn. I started to yawn because I couldn't find any nice chair.
It was a foggy day on the 6th of May in a scammel hauling bricks.
That's all we had. Now, I claim, because Dave is, I don't think realises this sometimes, he says, oh, I brought Paul in because he did that funny voice, you know, he's good at voices. I wrote the bloody thing. I wrote all the rest of it. But that's okay. It was his idea that we got permission from C.W. McCall, of course, which was the original hit record, Convoy. It was a song about CB radio. We didn't know what CB radio was in this country. You know, lorry drivers talking to each other, and it was a big hit. So we did Convoy GB. It got to number four in the charts. And the sad thing is that we did Top of the Pops, which I would love to think that video has, you know, got lost or been recorded over. I'd never want to see it again. It was appalling. We didn't sell another copy after that appearance.
Hello, this is Plastic Chicken, go off.
That's cool.
The road shows were great fun, especially if you got the West Country. Here I am now living down in Dorset, and it's... It is a wonderful part of the country, but it, for some reason, the weather always was great. I did Radio 1 roadshows up in the northeast, and that was not always quite as sunny. I did a roadshow once, and I was working to the backs of heads. Everybody was staring out to sea. I think it was somewhere in the West Country. Unbeknownst to me, it was a burial at sea taking place. Radio 1 was a family station then. It was what Radio 2 is now. The best ones, New Key, I think it was, like a natural amphitheatre, and you get 10,000 people or something, you know. It's just a guy playing records. But the warm-up was great, you know, we'd have competitions and everything, and also make them part of a kind of a conspiracy. We'd say, the sun is shining down here, and it's not, but they all join in, and isn't it? Yeah. And Johnny Beerling was the creator of that and deserves every credit because it was a great PR thing. I mean, there aren't many people who were fans of Radio 1 who didn't at some point see a Radio 1 roadshow. Radio 1 Roadshow Wednesday. Radio 1 Roadshow Wednesday. Radio 1 Roadshow Wednesday. Radio 1 Roadshow
Wednesday. Today from the King's Parade, Cleethorpes with Paul Burnett. I see, thank you. Thank you, Tony, for a great programme.
What happens is, there's an industry, it is an industry, the music industry, and it comes from the streets, pop music comes from the streets. For a couple of years, it's all very exciting, and then the music industry, oh, this is what they want, and they reflect it back, and they start making music for that audience, or that sound that has been all the rage for the last 2 years. And then it becomes predictable and a bit bland. Something happens, the Beatles came along and changed everything. But all it was a kind of re-energising of the music. And then punk came along. That really blew everything. And I was a victim of it. I mean, I could see when I was on Radio 1 then, I did a gig with Madness. It was Madness. We all were going on, and suddenly I'm wondering, is it raining? I'm getting spat on. I'm getting spat on because the punk generation regarded all those of us who had been on the radio, you know, Radio 1. For, it hurt a bit because I was one of the ones that really was excited by it all, not the lunatic sort of fringe. What happens is there has to be an initial kind of wildness that perhaps I wasn't ready for, but it paves the way for Squeeze and a whole bunch of bands that that wouldn't have made it if it hadn't been for that. But anyway, I'm being covered in gob, I was, you know. I remember going backstage, walking into Madness, and Suggs, is it? Suggs, what the hell happened to you? I was like, I think they want you on now. You know, the question that and really annoys me, it became very much the thing back in the 90s and 80s when the people started, people who ran radio stations, all the commercial radio stations, oh, it couldn't be as simple as that, could it? It could be as simple as somebody being enthusiastic about music and just going on there and projecting that enthusiasm and talking to people and all. No, no, they had to have focus groups and make a science out of it and everything else. And the one question they used to infuriate me was, tell me, who do you imagine is listening? Describe your listener to me. Well, that is ridiculous. That is just ridiculous. I'm on the radio, I'm in a studio, and you know, the best person who had the answer to it, and what annoyed me was, I could say this, and people would then think, oh, he's avoiding the issue or something. John Peel, who's respected, lovely guy, miss him very much, he was asked that question on a TV documentary. And he's driving his car there, I remember, always remember. And he looked a bit bewildered by the question. Well, me, basically, I'm talking to me. You know, I play what I like to hear, and I hope that this is... That's exactly the way I felt.
Radio 1.
Radio 1. Speaking personally, I mean, just to walk through the doors at Broadcasting House, the famous building that looks like a ship front... that I grew up with, to walk through those doors and the, you know, commissionaires, you know, give you a little nod and everything. I never got over that. I just thought, oh, this is, you know, who knew? Who thought I'd ever come to this? You run up the stairs, marble stairs, to the studio. What was fun about it was that radio, it was kind of, not like it is now, these vast studios. There's Radio 3 behind you, Radio 3. And you'd be all just divided by the glass. And Terry Wogan up across the corridor doing his show. And we'd talk to each other while, you know, like that. We're all together. I was in the studio once, and Terry, a lovely man, as everybody knows, of course. I used to have Newsbeat in the middle of my show, 15 minutes of the... So I'd wander across to Terry and have a chat, and he was always, you know, really, you know... He was somebody who never did any preparation for my shows, and he boasted about it, and rightly so, because to me, that's exactly what that kind of radio is. You know, if you can do it, you know, you just wing it. The music was what the people were tuning in for, and, you know, the bits in between, you know, just light banter, and of course, Terry, being Irish, was brilliant at it. I was in the studio, though, when something happened that could have stopped his career in its tracks. It was Remembrance Day, you know, we're buying poppies and all that, and he had a tape, reel-to-reel tape. It was Douglas Bader, the well-known legless fighter pilot, telling us why we should buy the poppy. And he's talking to me and everything, so he's on, and then he looks at his watch and realizes it's coming to an end, looks at his record, queuing it up the way he used to on turntables, you know, and he said, and to his horror, he realizes that this is a very inappropriate record to play at this point. By now, the tape is now run. Oh, there's old Douglas there telling us why we should buy it. And what a wonderful man. And he's waffling like you. And he's thrown the record off. It's landed at my feet in the corner of the studio. And he's anything. Anyway, let's all get out there and buy those poppies, because it's really important to remember the lives that we have now are very much down to. And anyway, here's something to take us into. He had no idea what he's playing. Thankfully, it was better than the one he'd thrown on the floor, which was Andy Fairweather Low and Wide Eyed and Legless. It was a big hit record at the time. It was, you know. I mean, can you imagine? Thank you. Thank you, Douglas, there. That's wonderful. Here's a nice bit of music. Can you imagine? The shit that would have hit the fan. And the great thing was, though, I thought I was going to shoe into Radio 2, because in those last year or so, I depped for David Hamilton on his show on Radio 2. And in fact, I found out later that he didn't do me any favours at all. Derek Chinnery said, we wish Paul all the best with Radio 2. And I forget her name, the guy who was head of Radio 2, hadn't been consulted, you see, about this. Because he read that and he said, well, that's it, we can't touch him for a year. A year is a long time. For me, it fizzled out. I knew the way things were going and like that, and I had a good run. Pretty devastating time, really. But I was a little more sanguine about it because I thought I was going to... because I'd been told that Radio 2, you know, and I'd done some work for them, as I say. I'm sure Derek didn't mean to screw it for me, but he did by doing that, you know. Can't touch him for a year. You know, like I say, in radio, if you're off the air for a year... I mean, I wasn't. I went up to Bradford. Penine Radio, Stereo 96. I was offered a job at the breakfast show there, and very good money and everything, and commercial radio. I was back in commercial radio after Luxembourg. That was all right. Everybody treated me so well up there. I was thinking, oh, what's it going to be like, you know, resentful or whatever. No, it was lovely. One of the things all radio stations did at that time, I suppose they still do, auctions and the like. Well, the same was in Bradford. They had their own charity for local tune, I think. And what happens, everybody, all these businesses give these things that you could auction off on the air. It's a real pain. Nobody likes doing it. You know, it's just, you know, play a record and then, right, we've had the bids coming in. And you have a list of all these things. And they're in the studio, these things. And one of them was... and on the list, it was described as a cuddly pink elephant. That's what it was. A big, huge, about 5 foot tall. I'm doing this. You start £5, £10 to the flood. You have a team of people all taking the phone calls, and of course you keep having to repeat this thing. It's a cuddly pink elephant. Cuddly pink elephant. So it loses its sense. A cuddly pink elephant became, and this is what I was saying on the air. I shall reenact it for you. They're all saying, right, cut it off at right, £100. We've got the piddly cunt elephant. The piddly cunt elephant is gone for, thank you so much. I'm so grateful for that. So anyway, that's the piddly cunt elephant sold now. We sold the piddly cunt elephant. Over and over again, I'm saying piddly cunt elephant. Anyway, here's the terrible thing. They're all this. So I've got it all in hand, and I kill all the music and everything. I go up to the microphone and very archly, I'm terribly sorry, I appear to have been saying piddly cunt. I thought they were wrong about the word piddly. I didn't even know I was saying the second. I was there for another year after that, so, you know. And then from then I went to Capital Radio, and 10 very happy years, I must say. So enjoyable, great. Kenny Everett I worked with. Funny, we had the same sense of humour. We both were adored a TV show called The Larry Sanders Show on TV, an American TV show about a chat show host and everything. Capital Gold had been hugely successful. I mean, in fact, it became something of a threat to the FM station, because although it got listeners in the same sort of ballpark area, for some reason they couldn't sell it. That's what they told us. They couldn't sell it. I remember walking in to the Capitol building in Houston. Oh, it was like somebody had died. All the guys had been called in. It's like we'd all been called in to a meeting, and one by one were being. And I was one of the last ones to go in. I walked in, and they're all sat there. Mike Reed. They're all been. That was it. Told, you know, it's all over. Thank you very much. Of course, I'm going to go in now. And I walked in, and he sat there behind his desk, Richard Park. And he said, oh, sit down, Paul. I don't know what you've heard, but there's a few changes. And I'm ready. I'm all ready for it. He says, so you'll be doing the... I'm still with a job. There's only Tony and I, Tony Blackburn and I, were kept on after this, what do they call it, culling, a DJ culling. Now, I have to, that was great, you know, but I had to go out, cheer the other guys with that, you know, that kind of face where you try to hide the fact that I've still got a job. You know, obviously, you know, you try to be sensitive and everything, and they all go, oh, well, you know, no, I seem to have escaped the, you know, and all that kind of, it was terrible. Oh, really? And they're trying to be also, just wanted to say, you lucky bastard. Well, no, they're, oh, well done. They're going, about as sincere as I was about being, oh, I'm sorry about you. But I only had another year, and then it was all over. Tony was the last one to leave, you know.
Simon, the number one in the States, but not over here. Didn't even make the top 20. 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. And now, the Kingsmen from 1964, Louie Louie, here on 1548 AM, Capital Gold.
I actually got away lightly in terms of... but he'd have some guys in his... After every show, I'd like you to, you know, come in and... I've been with him when, you know, some guys on the air. Conversation, he just... Excuse me a minute, Paul, I just... And then he'd be listening and shaking. He did, I'll tell you what he wanted to me. I was on the air, and the studios at the Capitol were next to a corridor like that. Now, the corner, I was on at lunchtime, and I'm doing me a bit, I think it's all going. Out of the corner of my eye, I see him standing at the window, shaking his head, side to side, looking down at the floor, like that. And but that was for my sake. He did it deliberately. It was just to keep you, you know. So, and of course, you know, want to go to the toilet straight after that, you know.
Classic gold.
But I joined Classic Gold in Dunstable. I was there for 10, 12 years. That was great, working with guys I'd known. One of the common denominators of all these stations I've worked for is that from 1975, every week I was on the BBC World Service, and it went right through till 2000, year 2000. And I think I got a little award for longest, you know, something, whatever. And that was interesting. I did the chart show. First of all, the chart show, and then I did the vintage chart show, which, you know, was just, you know, solid gold chart show. The funny thing is, it was my idea, and I was well pissed off when they gave it to Jimmy Savile. Jimmy Savile did it for about 3 months, and of course, people couldn't understand what he was saying, you know. A big letter saying, what is this? And so they gave it to me, and so I did that show for until the year 2000.
The Beaks are supported by New Order, but in the World Service Top 20, it's the other way around. Echo and the Bunnymen's current single still hasn't made the chart, but New Order are up another three places to number four with True Faith.
I know that radio stations have been a little... I mean, God, I'm retired, that's fair enough, but I still want to do it, and I still think I have something to offer, you know. You know, they're not wheezy just yet. But the yew tree business has... I remember when it first, hit the fan and everything about Jimmy Savile. Doreen Davis, I was at a function with her, and she said, you know, we're all tainted by this. And I said, well, no, I mean, that's Jimmy Savile, you know, but... She was right. I didn't realise how serious it was. I mean, obviously it was appalling. And I can hand on heart say none of us knew. Whether people further up the chain, you know, the high, you know, because of what he did, he made himself so powerful that nobody dare go there. You know, but that's bugger all to do. He was never part... So what annoys me is... People talk about the Radio 1 team at that time, where we'd do road shows. We'd go to a town, coincidentally, it was always about to open a new commercial radio station. We would then always go in there a week before, live in a hotel together, all, you know, doing shows and outside broadcast, blitzing, quite amusing at the time. But Savile was never part of that. Savile was a separate entity who recorded his shows. The only time he ever took part in anything, if there was a photo opportunity, the front page of the Radio Times on the 10th anniversary of Radio 1, we're all there. He turns up, lies down at the front there with his show suit and everything. But we just thought he was a weird, you know, eccentric... It really did. And what I love about now doing work for BBC Radio Solent, the fact that it's the BBC... Obviously, I'm regarded as being a safe bet.
No, Steph, thank you very much. I did ask for sugar in the tea. Sorry. Anyway, yes, it's lovely to be here at the BBC across the south, of course. Solent, Berkshire, Oxford, Sussex, Surrey, you name it, we're on it. Well, if it's in the south, anyway, it's 3.5 minutes.
You would
past
think,
o'clock.
You know, when you you'd peak, say, most successful, Radio One, obviously. And I think of all the radio stations that I've worked for with great affection. Mostly the people I work with. People you work for is a different matter. Alan Keane at Radio Luxembourg, wonderful boss. And that is, that those years, 74, that original drive over the Ardennes, you know, with my plane being flown over there and then getting there and meeting Nicole and our boys being born there and, you know, it changed my life totally. But it was the team we worked for as well. That's so important, I think, for any radio station, really. If you've got a good team, keep it together as long. Because the public are very, very affectionate about that sound, you know, that and you all knew each other's and you could, references to each other were not lost on the audience. They knew who you were talking about, they knew who you were making fun of and having a little joke at. Five Live, I think, is a brilliant radio station. I'm not that much into sport. But I do listen because they seem to have that kind of camaraderie thing. And as far as I can tell, they've had the same team pretty much for a long time. I used to listen to Five Live driving into Dunstable to do, you know, the M1, stuck in the traffic, M25. You know, Five Live, that's why I grew to really be quite fond of it. And on one occasion, they did, inviting people to phone in with their experiences of unisex toilets. Don't know how that came about. So I phoned in. I said, I won't leave my name because I work for another radio station. It was an answer phone. So I left this on. And this is what I left on there. But I used to work for the BBC and I had occasion to work again a few years later. And I had not realised that the toilets had become unisex. To me, these toilets were just down the corridor. And I just thought that. So I went into the toilet and I, shall we say, let one rip. I broke wind in what I took to be a very masculine way, very, you know, loud, you know, in the toilet. If you can't do it there, where can you do it? To my horror, Gloria Hunniford's voice from the next cube. Here's the best thing. Is that you, Maureen? Who's Maureen?
All the hard-working mums in the world, especially yours,
saying that we think she's lovely, including...
Don't forget, we were kind of pioneers, really. DJs, radio DJs, you know, there hadn't been our kind, like Top 40, like American-style DJs. And so, you know, and out of that grew the commercial radio thing. And we used to fondly imagine, wouldn't it be great if we guys ended up running radio stations, or some of us who want to go that way, and they would know your problems, they would appreciate to... No. I defy anybody to have worked for somebody who's been a DJ on the radio and not recognise that they resent not being on the air. You're getting all the credit. And when we started, we were working for people who used to say, you know, I don't know how you do what you do. They'd walk in the studio, you had no scripts, no nothing, you just do your stuff. And they would say, I just don't know how you do. That's what you want. That's what you want.
Top of the stat record in the 208 trendsetting pacemaking top 30. Number one, Gilbert O'Sullivan and...
Because the thing about what we do is, and very often I like to mention Jock today, like I mentioned Pete Murray, obviously, you know, Jack Jackson, you know, occasionally I mention his name and describe what he did.
The other day I saw a very old film called War at Sea on one of the late, late, late shows. It was a duel between a German U-boat commander...
What we do, it's gone, you know, we don't make records, we don't write books or whatever, you know, so you're very much... quite short-lived. In some people remember you and remember, oh, I remember this. I meet people and they say, oh God, I remember, and like that, that's lovely. But for the most part, DJs come and go, and it's you're lucky if they remember, you know, your name and everything.